The subject of this second tape concerns the principles of mineral balancing science. Some of these principles are the principle of energy and of the energy pathway. Another is the idea of the oxidation rate and how this relates to the stages of stress and the concept of internal and external stress. Then we will look at oxidation types and the characteristic of the fast, mixed, and slow oxidizers. The energy concept. The energy concept is one that is familiar in biochemistry, but is not really understood in terms of health. It is simply the idea that our health depends on the proper storage and release of energy within our body's cells. All body functions depend on the availability of energy in order to be performed. The energy pathway and the chemical regulators of the energy pathway must be functioning properly in order for optimal energy to be released at the cellular level. If energy is released in proper quantity on a consistent basis, bodily functions may be restored and regeneration can take place. Without sufficient energy, all body functions break down to one degree or another. This is the energy concept. The energy pathway. Energy is generated and released in the body via a specific pathway. It begins with the food that we ingest. The energy is actually originates from the sun. The sun's energy is impounded by plant life, which forms it into certain compounds called fats, proteins, and carbohydrates, which are really energy storage compounds. The food is then eaten, digested, and absorbed by our bodies. The resultant nutrients pass through the liver into the bloodstream and then are transported into the cells. Once inside the cells, these energy compounds are then burned or metabolized in the Krebs and glycolysis cycle in order to release their solar energy. This, in short, is a summary of the energy pathway. Now we'll talk about each step in more detail. The first step involves the fuel itself, the food. Food consists of two components. There are the fuel components, proteins, fats, and carbohydrates, and what we refer to as micronutrients, which include vitamins, minerals, enzymes, and other factors in foods. First, we'll look at the fuel components. Fats and oils are the highest energy-yielding foods. They yield 9 calories of energy per gram. The differences between fats and oils is that oils, by definition, are liquid at room temperature, while fats are solid. Oils are less saturated than hard fats because fewer of their bonds are tied up with hydrogen. For the purposes of this tape, however, we'll use, in general, the words fats and oils interchangeably to mean a certain classification of energy foods. There are also types of fats. Fats can be classified as long-chain fatty acids and short-chain fatty acids. The fatty acids will determine some of the characteristics of the fat food. Also, some fats contain essential fatty acids and some contain non-essential fatty acids to varying degrees. The essential fatty acids are arachidonic acid, linoleic acid, and linolenic acid. Arachidonic acid is found in animal products only, while linoleic and linolenic acid are more predominant in the vegetable oils. Fats are absorbed from the intestine very slowly. Fats also slow down the metabolic rate. For these reasons, we are going to discover that they are ideal for individuals who tend to burn their foods too rapidly. Fat is like a hardwood log that is initially slow to ignite, but once burning, it burns very hot and slowly releases energy. Carbohydrates are another class of energy foods. They serve as a source of quickly released high-energy fuel. Carbohydrates consist of two groups, the sugars and the starches. The basic carbohydrate unit is called a saccharide. Any sugar is only 1 to 3 saccharides linked together. A starch is, by definition, a polysaccharide, that is, several saccharides linked together in chains. The carbohydrate fuels release about 4 calories per gram, and they are absorbed more readily than fats. The simple sugars are absorbed very rapidly, some of them even being absorbed in the mouth and requiring very little digestion. For this reason, we'll see that the carbohydrate foods are, generally speaking, ideal for the slow metabolizer, the slow oxidizer. The slow oxidizer has trouble releasing his stored fuel, which is glycogen, and therefore it needs a ready supply of fuel so as to correct inefficient cellular production and release of energy. Protein is the third category of foods which can be used as fuel. About half of our ingested protein can be burned as fuel. More importantly, protein serves as structural material for many hormones, enzymes, and other compounds. Half of the protein, which is broken down into amino acids, can be burned in the glycolysis and Krebs cycles. There are ketogenic amino acids, which are metabolized the way fats are metabolized in the Krebs cycle, and there are glucogenic amino acids, which are metabolized like sugars. The content of a particular protein food varies. The digestion time of protein is dependent on a number of factors, some of them being the fat content. For example, protein is usually found in foods together with varying amounts of fat. There is also a class of proteins called purines. Purines are nucleoproteins such as adenine and guanine. They play an essential role in ATP production, which is the ultimate step in the breakdown and release of energy. High purine foods, as you'll see, are beneficial for the fast oxidizer. These are the basic categories of fuels. Most foods contain a mixture of fat, protein, and carbohydrate. However, each type of food can be classified as predominantly a protein food or a fat or a carbohydrate according to what it contains the most of. Different individuals require diets composed of varied percentages of these different fuels, just as different cars require different blends of gasoline. The first step of the body's energy pathway is digestion. In order to derive energy from ingested food, it must be digested. Digestion is a complex process and begins with chewing adequately to mechanically break down the food. In the mouth, the salivary enzyme, salivary amylase, begins to break down starches into sugars. That is why if you chew your food long enough, starchy foods become sweet. The food then enters the stomach where it must mix with hydrochloric acid and pepsin in order to digest protein. Hydrochloric acid is necessary in order for pepsin to be active. Hydrochloric acid production depends on adequate quantities of sodium and potassium. If there is a deficiency of these two minerals, the production of hydrochloric acid is proportionally diminished. Sometimes if there is an excess of sodium and potassium, hydrochloric acid is in excess, and these individuals may suffer from an hyperacid condition. It is important to note that ulcers may be present in both hyperacid and hypoacid conditions. This is because if there isn't sufficient hydrochloric acid, the body will substitute other organic acids to help break down food. These other acids can damage the stomach wall and produce ulcers. Adequate levels of sodium and potassium depend on adrenal function. The adrenal glands, through the action of aldosterone and cortisone, raise sodium and potassium levels in the blood and body tissues. Excessively high adrenal activity, such as occurs as a result of stress, can result in very high levels of sodium and potassium. This in turn can give rise to high hydrochloric acid levels and ulcers, such as found in individuals under stress. The next stage in digestion occurs in the small intestine, where the acidity of the stomach secretions stimulates the alkaline pancreatic juice and bile to be secreted. The bile and the pancreatic enzymes are mixed with the food. The fast oxidizer often has a low tissue zinc level, resulting in a deficiency of the zinc-dependent pancreatic enzymes, although both oxidation types may suffer from a zinc deficiency. We recommend pancreatic enzymes especially for the fast oxidizer. In the small intestine, protein breakdown into amino acids is completed. Fats are broken down into fatty acids and glycerides, and the starch is broken down to monosaccharides. Assimilation is the next step. The nutrients absorb through the intestinal wall and pass to the liver. In the liver, many complex changes take place. Some of the fuels are stored as glycogen. Some are converted to other forms. Some are released into the blood. Cholesterol is synthesized and used as a precursor for the adrenal and other steroid hormones. However, enough glycogen must be continuously converted to blood sugar to move on to the cells to meet its energy requirements. What we often find in the slow metabolizer is an inadequate release of glycogen from the liver. This occurs because adrenaline and the adrenocortical hormones are required to convert glycogen to glucose. When adrenocortical hormone secretion is low, an inadequate amount of blood glucose results. In the fast oxidizer, the situation is reversed with a excessive conversion of glycogen to glucose, and therefore an excessive amount of sugar being sent to the cells. This speeds up the burning rate, and we will discuss this in greater detail later. Transport across cell membranes is an important step in the energy pathway. Glucose and other nutrients must be transported across the cell membrane in order to enter the cells, the ultimate destination of the fuel. Sometimes this is a problem, especially in the slow oxidizer. Transport of nutrients is impaired due to low sodium and potassium levels. Sodium and potassium, together with magnesium, are necessary for the sodium pump mechanism to function effectively. In the fast oxidizer, there is often an excessive influx of nutrients through the cell wall, including hormones, such as thyroid hormone, and this tends to speed up the rate of cellular oxidation. Once the fuel is finally inside the cell, they must be burned or oxidized in the glycolysis and Krebs cycles. 20% of the body's energy is generated in the glycolysis cycle, which is concerned with the burning of sugar. 80% of the energy is generated in the citric acid or Krebs cycle, which is primarily concerned with the burning of fat and proteins. In order for these energy cycles to function properly, to go through to completion, various nutrients such as manganese, zinc, magnesium, B vitamins are required. Calcium, iron, copper, vitamin B12, folic acid are required in the Krebs cycle, for example. If any of these nutrients are deficient, the energy cycle will not go through to completion. This, then, is the energy pathway. Every step must be intact, or there will be an aberration and difficulty at some point, and improper release of energy will result. Substitute energy pathways may be taken by the body, which generate an excess of certain metabolic waste products, such as lactic acid. But the energy pathway is a key to health. Now that we've discussed the fuel elements, the protein, fat, and carbohydrate, and their fate, we will discuss the micro elements, which the most important of which are the minerals. And this discussion will be very limited because of the time available on this tape, but this material is available in other books and in more advanced materials. We'll begin with calcium. Calcium, besides its use as the main structural element of bones, calcium plays an important role in nervous and muscular function. It stabilizes the cell membrane potential. In this way, calcium exerts a sedative effect upon nervous and muscular tissue and the nervous system. Calcium is intimately related to thyroid, adrenal, and parathyroid gland functioning. Calcium suppresses glucocorticoid secretion by the adrenal glands and suppresses thyroid activity as well. Calcium is one of the four electrolytes, which is responsible for regulating osmotic and electrolytic balance in the blood and tissues. Calcium antagonizes potassium, lead, cadmium, phosphorus, and sometimes magnesium as well. Calcium is also required for the release of insulin from the pancreas. Finally, calcium has powerful effects upon mental and emotional functioning. Excess tissue calcium is associated with fatigue, depression, rigid personality, and withdrawal. Calcium deficiency is associated with irritability, anxiety, and hyperkinetic behavior. Magnesium. Along with potassium, magnesium is the major intracellular element and is required for hundreds of critical enzymes within the cell. Energy production depends directly upon the availability of adequate magnesium. For example, the conversion of ATP to ADP and from ADP back to ATP requires magnesium. Magnesium is also a sedative element and is especially needed for proper cardiac function. Deficiency causes arrhythmias and can result in arterial spasms, hypertension, and heart attack. Magnesium inhibits insulin release from the pancreas. And magnesium is intimately associated with calcium metabolism. It helps keep calcium in solution, and along with vitamin B6, prevents the formation of kidney stones and development of arterial plaque. Sodium. Sodium is the body's major solvent element. Sodium levels are regulated mainly by aldosterone secretion from the adrenal glands. This is why patients who consume little or no salt may have elevated sodium readings. They are retaining all of their sodium due to high aldosterone output. Others who eat salt have low tissue sodium readings because aldosterone levels are low. As a result, sodium cannot be retained in their tissues. 30% of the body's sodium is stored in the bones, where it helps keep calcium soluble. A deficiency of sodium results in calcium buildup or deposition in body tissues. Sodium is the main extracellular electrolyte and helps maintain water balance, blood pressure, muscle and nerve function, and proper transport of nutrients in and out of cells. Potassium. 98% of our potassium is intracellular, where it is involved in energy production and many cellular functions. Loss of potassium results in diminished cell membrane potential, interference with transport of nutrients across cell membranes, and numerous metabolic dysfunctions. Potassium levels in unwashed hair samples are an excellent indicator of glucocorticoid secretion. Washing the hair for even a few minutes invalidates potassium readings because potassium is a highly soluble element. Potassium is a major electrolyte and assists in maintaining fluid balance, osmotic balance, and acid-base balance in the blood and tissues. Copper. Copper is required for several critical enzyme systems, including the cytochrome system, involved in energy production, and superoxide dismutase and catalase systems, which scavenge damaging free radicals. Copper is required to change iron from the ferric to the ferrous form and to incorporate iron into hemoglobin. Copper is necessary for cross-linking of collagen tissues and for the retention of calcium in the bone. Copper is also needed as an integral part of the biogenic amines, which serve as neurotransmitters. Copper is also closely related to estrogen function, and copper imbalances are intimately related to many female disorders and emotional difficulties. Iron. Besides its essential role as part of the hemoglobin molecule, iron is required for the electron transport system. This is the end part after the Krebs cycle involved in energy production, in which the major production of ATP takes place. Iron is also involved in the catalase and peroxidase enzyme systems as well. Zinc. Zinc is required for at least 70 important enzymes. 32 of the 50 states today have zinc-deficient soils, leading to widespread subclinical deficiency of this element. The availability of zinc limits the production of practically all cellular proteins because zinc is involved in RNA transferase. Carbonic anhydrase, another zinc-containing enzyme, is essential in the maintenance of the pH balance of the body. Alcohol dehydrogenase, alkaline phosphatase, and deoxythymidine kinase are also zinc metalloenzymes. The highest concentration of zinc is found in the retina of the eye and in the male reproductive tract. Zinc is also needed for the sense of taste and smell, the synthesis and release of insulin, skin, and for wound healing. Manganese. Manganese deficiency is extremely widespread. It is critical for the energy-producing systems within the mitochondria of the cells. Manganese is also needed for cholesterol synthesis, for neuromuscular function, for synthesis and catabolism of proteins, and for the transport of insulin. Manganese appears to help protect the delicate mitochondrial enzymes from attack by superoxide radicals. As an activator of the enzyme glycosyl transferase, manganese is needed for proper bone and cartilage formation. Although the names of these enzymes are tongue twisters, they are nevertheless the key to survival and health. Manganese imbalance is also intimately related to epilepsy and schizophrenia. Chromium. Chromium in the form of glucose tolerance factor is a cofactor with insulin and is necessary to attach insulin to cell membranes. Chromium has also been found effective in reducing arterial plaque by raising high-density lipoprotein levels and lowering cholesterol levels. Depleted soil chromium, eating refined foods, and eating a diet high in sugar has contributed to widespread chromium deficiency among Americans. No doubt this is partially responsible for the epidemic of hypoglycemia and diabetes in our population. These are some of the major minerals that are important for the body, although there are several others, such as molybdenum, cobalt, that we will not discuss at this time. The vitamins are also essential, and these are other micronutrients. B1, B2, B3, B6, these all play essential roles in the Krebs cycle and in the glycolysis cycle of energy production. Vitamin A is essential for normal adrenal function. It's also necessary for the integrity of mucous membranes and skin. Vitamin C has many functions. For example, it's needed for collagen growth and integrity, and it tends to speed up the oxidation rate, and it is needed for the adrenal glands. Vitamin D tends to enhance calcium absorption. Vitamin E is essential as an antioxidant. We could go on with these micronutrients. However, I would prefer to spend the time talking about other central concepts, such as oxidation rate and the stress response. We find that it is not enough that the energy pathway be corrected. There is another factor, and in health, and this is what we call the ideal oxidation rate. An equivalent analogy is to think of an engine of a car. Not only must you have an entirely intact fuel system, consisting of a fuel tank, fuel pump, fuel filter, carburetor, etc., and all the steps to get the fuel burned, but also the engine must run at the right RPM. If it's not running at the correct RPM, a tremendous reduction in power production occurs. The same phenomena occurs in a human being. So not only must we have the oxidation pathway, but the oxidation rate concept is that there are regulators of this energy metabolism which can speed up or slow down the entire burning process. These regulators are of two types. One is through the autonomic nervous system and the adrenal medulla. Stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system causes the adrenal gland and thyroid to speed up and affects the metabolism in this way. When the parasympathetic nervous system is dominant, there is a slowdown effect. The second factor is interference anywhere along the energy production and release cycle. Depending on what kind of interference, it can cause either a speed up or a slowdown of the oxidation rate. For example, certain toxic metals may cause a speed up of the rate, as though the gas pedal in the car was stuck down. other interferences cause a slowdown in the rate. So these are the two ways that the energy pathway is regulated. The rate, that is, one through the nervous system and glands, and secondly, through individual defects in the energy pathway. The next concept is the stages of stress. Stress plays a very important role in the regulation of the energy pathway. Originally, Dr. Hans Selye discovered that stress initially results in a speed-up of both the thyroid and adrenal glands. This speed-up in metabolism, Dr. Selye called the alarm stage of stress. This is equivalent to a speeding up in the metabolic rate of energy expenditure. Individuals in this state are referred to as fast oxidizers. Later on, the effect of prolonged stress is to either cause impairment of the energy pathway or exhaustion of the adrenal glands, or both. The organism slows down, and the energy production rate becomes slower than normal. This is what we refer to as slow oxidation. So what we find is that stress has a direct effect on the energy pathways. This is an essential link and connection that we're going to explore further. Dr. Selye's theory was rather idealized because he was working with rats who were under controlled stress and lived in little cages. He found they went through very orderly stages of what he called alarm stage, where the glands speeded up, in other words, sympathetic dominance, then resistance, in which the organism began to slow down as the resistance actually declined and the organism was unable to cope. As the rats continued to be stressed, the exhaustion stage would occur, in which the glands became exhausted, energy levels continued to fall, and the organism went into a holding pattern to prevent death. If stress continued, death finally ensued. In actuality, when we work with people, we don't see these stages as well defined. There are too many other factors in the stress equation and in the chemistry and environments of human beings which cause the stages to appear less neatly defined. That is to say, for example, that stress on a human being is not a simple shock all the time. We find that some stresses will move an individual into fast oxidation, while other stressors will move them into slow oxidation. Also, the human being is usually contaminated with toxic metals and may also have a number of vitamin and mineral deficiencies, which may be unknown. These factors may have bizarre effects on the oxidation rate. Sometimes the metabolic rate will speed up. Sometimes it will slow down. So for this reason, the stages of stress, according to Selye, is a very useful, idealistic concept which we must modify if we are to make sense out of the way human beings respond to stress. But the basic stages are very valid, and you'll be able to discern this from a hair analysis, the alarm stage, resistance stage, exhaustion stage of stress. There are a number of factors which determine the stress response. Some of the factors that can contribute are the amount of stress, the biochemical integrity of the body to resist, which is to say the nutritional status, and the coping ability, which might be called the mental status or temperament of the person. Certain individuals go right into slow oxidation when they are stressed. Others remain in fast oxidation their whole life in spite of continuous severe stress. The amount of stress, the duration of stress, are external factors. The strength of the organism, its coping ability, and the temperament of the individual, either by genetics, nutritional inheritance, or by upbringing, are what we might call internal factors, which influence how a person responds to stress. The stress response is a very individualized matter. What is stressful for one may not be stressful for another. For example, if you don't like cats and someone brings a cat over, this could constitute quite a stress. On the other hand, if you're a cat lover and someone gives you a cat, it could reduce your stress. Individuals also handle stress very differently. Some people seem able to detach. Others become extremely upset at the slightest provocation and go through the entire stages of stress much more quickly. While there are limitations to this, there is a range, and sometimes when we're working with stress, it's important not to just assume that something is stressful until you know that it is. Sometimes what we think of as a stress is actually reducing another stress. For example, let's say a man is not happy around his wife at home for whatever reason. As a result, he spends much of his time at the office. If you just knew that he was spending all his time at the office, you might say, oh, you're working too hard. However, this activity is preventing perhaps another and a greater stress, and therefore is actually less hazardous to the individual. So it can be a little tricky. Another important concept is to differentiate internal and external stressors. We usually think of stressors as external: people, work, relationships, life situations, heat, cold, social pressures. These are what we think of as stressors. However, in the mineral balancing science, what we're working with really are internal stressors: nutritional deficiencies, nutritional excesses, imbalances, which are having just as profound an effect or more than the external stressors. As the organism becomes more exhausted, we are dealing more and more with internal stress. If you're a fast oxidizer, for example, in the early stage of stress, most of your stress is going to be external. The body is fairly healthy, and it's not causing a lot of resistance. As the body's resistance to stress diminishes, the body becomes more depleted and toxic, the energy pathway more severely impaired, then what you have is more internal stress caused by nutritional deficiencies and imbalances. This stress is added to your already existing external stressors. Sometimes you can eliminate all the external stress that an individual is suffering from. For example, they could quit their job, they could move somewhere else, but their health still doesn't improve because the nutritional depletion, the internal stressors, are still there from the previous pressures. This is an introduction to the stress concepts and how they fit into energy and the regulation of the energy pathway. Now we'll talk about oxidation types. The concept was first elaborated by Dr. George Watson, whose empirical research revealed that certain individuals responded to certain foods and certain vitamins and minerals in a very positive way, while other people responded unfavorably to the same nutrients and needed an entirely different set of nutrients. Dr. Watson employed blood tests and other tests to determine what was the difference. He wrote this up in a book called Nutrition and Your Mind. He discovered that the blood CO2 level and pH values were very different between individuals. Some people's blood pH was relatively less alkaline than others. Some were high in CO2, some were low in CO2. Dr. Watson labeled those with higher CO2 levels as fast oxidizers, those with lower CO2 levels as slow oxidizers. He was able to determine that the fast oxidizer was burning sugar too fast in the glycolysis cycle and had problems with the Krebs cycle. And this is why high-fat foods help those people. According to Watson, the slow oxidizer burns sugar too slowly in the glycolysis cycle and therefore has inadequate amounts of oxaloacetate, the major end metabolic product of glucose, to combine with acetate, the end product of fat, to produce energy. Slow oxidizers, therefore, require more of the carbohydrate foods and must restrict their fat intake. These individuals do well on carbohydrates and poorly on fats. Dr. Watson's book, Nutrition and Your Mind, is very excellent reading, but he did not go nearly as far as Dr. Pawlak has gone in exploring the intricacies of the oxidation rate and the energy pathways. However, Dr. Watson's work was a beginning and is a very key concept. Determining the oxidation rate. We use the first four macro minerals, calcium, magnesium, sodium, and potassium, as the primary indicators of an individual's oxidation rate. This is Dr. X's contribution. He worked for many years trying to ascertain oxidation types in a simple manner. He investigated hair analysis, where Dr. Watson investigated only blood analysis. Dr. Eck found that the calcium, magnesium, sodium, potassium levels give us a very good indicator of an individual's oxidation rate. In the balanced state, the numbers would be all approximately at the normal levels, which is calcium at 40 milligrams per cent, magnesium at 6, sodium at 25, and potassium at 10. These are empirical values that Dr. Eck arrived at by studying thousands of tests. By working on people and by seeing where the numbers began to even out, As they began to achieve a high level of health, these numbers were determined. Dr. Eck discovered that the fast oxidizer is characterized on a hair analysis chart by a low calcium and a low magnesium level, relative to the sodium and potassium. All four numbers may be above normal in certain instances, or they may all be below normal, but it is the ratios that are most important. The two ratios that Dr. Eck has decided upon to use as the indicators of oxygenation type are calcium to potassium and sodium to magnesium. Calcium to potassium ratio. This ratio, if it is less than 4:1, is one indicator of fast oxidation. The calcium-potassium ratio is referred to as the thyroid ratio because it is intimately related to thyroid function. We know that an overactive thyroid gland lowers calcium. A calcium-potassium ratio greater than 4:1, on the other hand, is associated with a slower thyroid and slow oxidation. The sodium-to-magnesium ratio. The sodium-to-magnesium ratio normally is 4.17 to 1. That is, a sodium of 25 divided by a magnesium of 6. A sodium-magnesium ratio greater than 4.17 to 1 is the other indicator of fast oxidation. A ratio less than 4.17 to 1 is associated with slow oxidation. This ratio is referred to as the adrenal ratio. Since the sodium level in particular is intimately related to aldosterone secretion from the adrenals. However, despite these designations, both ratios are tied up with both glands, the thyroid and the adrenal glands. The definition now of fast and slow oxidation. Fast oxidation is defined precisely as a calcium to potassium ratio less than 4:1 and a sodium to magnesium ratio greater than 4.17 to 1. Slow oxidation is defined as a calcium to potassium ratio greater than 4:1 and a sodium to magnesium ratio less than 4.17 to 1. If one of these ratios is higher than normal and the other is lower than normal, this is called mixed oxidation, which we'll deal with later. Now we'll talk about fast, slow, mixed, and balanced patterns and flexible patterns and their physiological and psychological characteristics. We'll begin with an ideal situation, the flexible oxidizer. An ideal situation would be what we might call a flexible oxidizer. Such a person's body would be able to speed up when it needs to, and then slow down to normal when a stressful situation is over with. It's like an engine of a car. If you need the extra power, you can step on the gas, and then when you want to slow down, it would slow down back down to cruising speed. This would be an ideal situation. What frequently occurs, unfortunately, is that one becomes locked into fast or slow oxidation. And this is the problem. The ideal would be that the person would be in control of the oxidation rate so that the least stress doesn't force them into fast or slow, and this too can put lots of strain. If a person were in control pretty much and had a flexible oxidizer, the hair chart would show a fairly balanced pattern. Characteristics of the fast oxidizer. The physiological and psychological characteristics of the fast oxidizer depend to a great extent on the chemical changes that occur. The falling of the tissue calcium levels causes a hyperirritable state of the muscles and the nervous system. Therefore, fast oxidizers tend to be irritable. They tend to have a quick mind. Their entire nervous system is placed on alert by lowering of the calcium and magnesium level. The fast oxidizer tends to have good muscle tone. When the calcium drops below a certain level, these people develop muscle spasms during the night while in bed. Calcium is a stabilizer of muscle and nerve cells. The fast oxidizer tends to run on nervous energy. They are high energy people. They are putting out. They are geared up to burn a lot of energy very rapidly. Nothing is wrong with this, except like running your car at full RPM all the time, it tends to wear the machinery out. These tend to be aggressive people, often volatile, and they speed up under stress. They get more volatile. They have good circulation. They tend to be warm because excessive thyroid and adrenal activity. Warm meaning their temperature. They tend to be extroverted outgoing people with a flair, and they have an excess of energy to burn. They're usually positive and outgoing when they're slightly to moderate fast oxidizers, and in the extreme form, the fast oxidizer is anxious, paranoid, and can be very domineering and aggressive. When fast oxidation becomes very extreme, the efficiency of the energy pathway severely declines, and the individual suffers from extreme fatigue. Physiologically, the fast oxidizer tends to have high histamine levels, and they're particularly prone to histaminic type of allergies. Because the thyroid gland is hyperactive, they tend to eat plenty and eat frequently. They must have high energy foods and fats in order to have optimal well-being. They tend to have the type of high blood pressure caused by low calcium and magnesium, which increases vascular tone, together with a high sodium level, which can cause fluid retention and a high blood volume, particularly if sodium level is high in relation to potassium. These are the type A personalities. They are prone to certain illnesses, leukemia, multiple sclerosis, certain forms of rheumatoid arthritis, frequent bowel movements, tissue acidity, because they produce an excess of the metabolic end products such as lactic acid, and they don't have sufficient calcium to neutralize the excessive lactic acid buildup. Normally, calcium combines with lactic acid to form calcium lactate. In early life, the fast oxidizer has a strong tendency to develop low blood sugar problems because they convert glycogen to glucose too rapidly. Therefore, they deplete their glycogen reserves. So they are prone to reactive hypoglycemia that is made much worse by eating sweets and oftentimes alcohol. Later in life, they frequently develop diabetes due to a zinc deficiency many times. Zinc, it is to be remembered, is necessary to produce and release insulin. This is a brief rundown of some of the characteristics of the fast oxidizer. Always remember that a controlled rise in oxidation rate is an appropriate response to stress. When it causes problems is when a person is locked into fast oxidation, can't slow down, doesn't know any other way to be, can't really relax, and then he's in trouble. Because, for example, fatigue itself is a stress, and the way to deal with fatigue is to slow down. These individuals, for either psychological or physical reasons, can't usually regulate their life. They're in a rut. Some people, after being in this state for a number of years, become accustomed to it. They think it's normal. They are very difficult to alter toward ideal values, because if you slow them down, they feel bad. They are used to being in fast oxidation. About 10 to 20% of our population are in the fast oxidizer category, but most of these people are what we would call temporary fast oxidizers. These people are in a temporary state of fast oxidation due to acute stress, and when they are placed on a corrective nutritional program, what happens is that they drop down into slow oxidation. Some fast oxidizers are temporarily fast due to a toxic metal, and it may take a period of time on the corrective program for them to return to their true oxidation rate. I mentioned previously that a very common oxidation type is the slow oxidizer under stress, which temporarily manifests as a fast oxidizer. The chart looks just like fast oxidation. We call it a temporary fast. A few clues to distinguishing a temporary fast from a true fast is that the former often have a high calcium and magnesium level, in other words, higher than normal levels, even though sodium and potassium are even higher ratio-wise. A second tip-off is an allergy to milk or dairy products, because we know that it's the slow oxidizers who usually have the milk allergy. Finally, a tip-off is when they have a low blood pressure. It is the slow oxidizers who tend to have low blood pressure. Some of the individuals who test as fast oxidizers, but who have a low blood pressure, meaning less than 110 over 70 or thereabouts, are temporary fast oxidizers. Now we'll talk about the slow oxidizer. At least 80% of our population are in the slow oxidizer category. It is to be remembered that the fast oxidizer is characterized by a low calcium and magnesium together with a high sodium and potassium level. What happens is, After a while, like running the engine of your car at full RPM for a long period of time, it begins to burn out. And the body literally burns out of essential nutrients. They are depleted faster than they can be replaced. This especially occurs with modern diets that are deficient in essential nutrients. It can happen to anyone, but it happens much more quickly with poor diet or wrong diet. What happens is the endocrine glands begin to weaken. Specifically affected are the thyroid and the adrenal glands. Usually the first gland to weaken is the adrenal glands. The sodium level begins to fall. As this happens, the person becomes a fast oxidizer with a sodium-potassium inversion, or a low sodium-potassium ratio. We call this state the burned-out fast oxidizer. This is a fast oxidizer pattern with a low sodium-to-potassium ratio. What happens next is that the potassium level begins to fall to keep pace with the sodium, because this ratio is so critical that the body always maintains it, if it can. Next thing you know, both sodium and potassium levels fall below normal, and the person passes into a state of mixed oxidation, where one of the ratios may be high, one of them may be low. Finally, they end up with both the sodium and potassium level below normal because the adrenal glands are exhausted. The adrenals can no longer produce aldosterone and cortisone in proper quantity. As a consequence, both sodium and potassium electrolyte levels drop. As sodium and potassium levels decline, normally there are corresponding changes in calcium and magnesium. That is, as potassium levels drop, as cortisone activity drops, the calcium level begins to rise. It will rise above the ideal value. Magnesium also rises with the calcium. As a result, we end up in a state with calcium and magnesium high, sodium and potassium low. The definition, according to the mineral balancing science, of the slow oxidizer is a calcium to potassium ratio greater than 4 to 1 and a sodium to magnesium ratio less than 4.17 to 1. If the criteria of those ratios are met, the individual is a slow oxidizer. Once again, all four numbers may be higher than normal, all four numbers may be lower than the normal line. It doesn't matter, it's the ratios that determine the oxidation rate. The slow oxidizer tends to a different set of difficulties from the fast. The slow oxidizer has a high calcium level, both level and ratio-wise to potassium. When we think of calcium as the stabilizer of the nervous system, we might even look at this high calcium as an adaptive mechanism that prevents further adrenal burnout. It is much like an engine that has been running so fast it's about to tear itself to pieces. The solution is to put a governor on the engine, which turns off the ignition or slows it down. What the ignition is to a car, calcium is to the body. Calcium acts as a brake here. A rise in calcium slows down the nervous system, slows down the mind. When sodium and potassium levels are low, transport of minerals in and out of the cells is also impaired. Thus, slow oxidizers are prone to all kinds of problems having to do with getting nutrients into their cells and waste products out of their cells. Psychologically, largely because of the fatigue which they experience, these individuals tend also to experience apathy or depression. They may even become despairing and hopeless when the oxidation rate is very low. Thoughts of suicide may even ensue due to weak glandular system. Slow oxidizers are usually introverted because they don't have sufficient energy to be expressive and outgoing. A great many divorces occur when one partner gets burned out and goes into slow oxidation. Because they don't have energy, it is not that they don't love their spouses, they just don't have the energy sufficient to express love. Sexual desire often decreases because there's insufficient energy. When a person is exhausted, the body shuts down sexual activity. These people often look to the past and live in the past. They are often rigid, which is a defense mechanism to keep them going in their daily life. Their bodies may also become rigid due to soft tissue calcification. They often have accumulated copper, which affects the mind and causes fatigue, depression, spaciness, schizoid, and detached behavior. They tend to have cold fingers and toes because of diminished thyroid and adrenal function. The slow oxidizer often has low blood pressure in the early stages because aldosterone and sodium levels are low. However, later on, the excess calcium may begin to build up in the arteries or kidneys. Hardening of the arterial walls from calcium deposits is called arteriosclerosis and raises blood pressure. Thus, later in life, they tend to have high blood pressure. Slow oxidizers tend toward alkalinity because they are not metabolizing rapidly enough, and too much calcium neutralizes lactic acid too quickly. They tend to be constipated. They can't handle high-fat foods because it slows down their rate of metabolism. They tend to eat light or desire lighter meals compared to fast oxidizers. These individuals are prone to the histopenic type of allergies, histopenic meaning low histamine. Slow oxidizers are prone to anaerobic glycolysis because of problems transporting blood sugar and thyroid hormone into the cells. The T3 and T4 levels and glucose levels may be normal in the blood and yet be low in the cell. It is a cellular hypoglycemia, a cellular hypothyroidism. They suffer from insufficient gluconeogenesis, that is, insufficient conversion of glycogen to glucose, and release, and insufficient release of glucose from the liver. This is because the adrenal cortical hormones are needed for release of glucose from the liver. These hormones are being produced in less than optimal amounts, and therefore the entire energy cycle is severely impaired. They tend toward symptoms of low thyroid activity, cold, fatigued, dry skin, dry hair, and in females, menstrual irregularities, and occasionally amenorrhea. Psychological and temperament factors may also have a bearing on oxidation rate. The oxidation rate is really a reflection of the entire being, so I don't want to give the impression that chemistry is the only determinant. One's emotions can thrust one into fast or right into slow oxidation. Usually it does take a chemical imbalance to help that to happen and to maintain the subsequent status quo, but it is certain that one's emotions and lifestyle play a vital role in determining oxidation types. There are innate temperaments that are slow oxidizer temperaments. These people just seem to drift into slow oxidation and remain there. They feel comfortable there. They are difficult to change. Sometimes as their metabolic rate increases, they feel uncomfortable. Their whole personality has been built around being a hypothyroid, slow oxidizing person. They don't know these terms, but all the characteristics they come to identify as themselves are those of slow oxidation. So there are temperament and psychological factors associated with both slow and fast types. This is where some psychological counseling can help a person see the pattern that may be blocking metabolic correction. Mixed oxidation. There are other oxidation types. A mixed oxidizer has either the adrenal or the thyroid ratio fast and the other ratio slow. Mixed oxidizers are classified as either slow mixed or fast mixed. If the overactive gland is proportionally faster than the other gland is slow, then the individual is classified as a fast mixed oxidizer. If the underactive gland is proportionally more slow than the other gland is fast, then the patient is classified as a slow mixed oxidizer. Mixed oxidation is considered a transitional state. Especially on a first test, there may be other things going on to cause this mixed oxidation, such as toxic metal accumulation or some other imbalance, and it may take a year, or it may happen quickly, that this person will finally resolve into slow or fast. Another factor causing temporary mixed oxidation is excess stress. An illness will do this. A toxic metal being eliminated will do this. An emotional shock of certain types will do this. If you catch the person on the hair test at the time when they're going through this, you may have a state of mixed oxidation because the glands temporarily speed up and the chemistry temporarily shifts. Mixed oxidation also occurs in very sick people. The glands are simply out of synchronization. There is something causing the glands not to function harmoniously. Mixed oxidation can be mild, with the four values close to normal, or it can be very unbalanced. Just like fast oxidation, which can be severe or mild, and slow oxidation can be severe or mild, so mixed oxidation can have the values close to normal, or the ratios can be very unbalanced. This covers the concept of mixed oxidation. Remember once again that emotions can generate the oxidation types and can reinforce the patterns. A particular case that I want to mention is called stress seekers. This is a defense mechanism that many people don't even realize that they have or are using. These are individuals who use stress to bring up their sodium and potassium levels. The health-minded ones will take up strenuous exercise, which stimulates the adrenal glands. Other stress seekers indulge in coffee, cigarettes, or workaholics, or they manage to put other stress on themselves, such as creating financial stress or worry, which raises their sodium-potassium levels. You can always tell these people because if they stop exercising, they feel awful, or if they reduce their coffee, or if they don't have something to worry about, they feel bad. Exercise is actually one of the most potent of these stimulants. Some of these stress seekers are fast oxidizers, and they want to remain fast as their adrenal glands are burning out. So they take up jogging, coffee, cigarettes, or something else. Or they use the emotion of anger or resentfulness to put stress on their body to keep themselves in fast oxidation. Others are slow oxidizers, and they can't bear the depression, and they take up these stimulants to move them temporarily out of slow oxidation. It is sometimes difficult to explain why people should gradually stop these stimulating activities, but if one is to get well, it is necessary to reduce the stress. It is not rebuilding them, it just stimulates them, and we can bring up the sodium and potassium levels using nutrients and foods.